Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Inflation is the new COVID? Question mark. There's no amount of masking and social distancing that will protect you from the price hikes, that's for sure. White House econ advisor Jared Bernstein on Squawk Box yesterday, being interviewed by the usually pliable Andrew Ross Sorkin, a little bit less so, not completely buying and reciting the Biden-Putin price hike propaganda. Jared Bernstein on inflation, economic advisor to President Biden, they didn't miss much.
Absolutely, because, well, first of all, we're having an inflationary story in every advanced economy in the globe, and in fact, inflation is historically elevated everywhere, so it's certainly not just one country's fiscal or monetary policy.
But then the question is, what did the White House miss? And what's the lesson of that?
I don't think the White House missed much at all in the
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Boy, there's a lot there in that short statement. One, the White House didn't miss anything. It's interesting that you would say that, Mr. Bernstein, because you had the White House, the Biden administration Treasury Secretary, Captain Kangaroo, on the Sunday talkies and spinning interviews what? Last week, saying that she was wrong about inflation. Of course you were wrong about inflation. You didn't miss much. You missed the whole thing. You missed that it wasn't transitory, which was the party line until that party line could no longer be sustained. Isn't that right? What else did you miss? You missed that inflation is going to cost the average American family more than $5,500 this year, according to Moody's. The Congressional Budget Office has a similar number.
Yeah, it's $460 extra bucks a month for a family of four. And that's money that people didn't plan for.
$5,000.
Right.
And when you're talking about median household income in this country of $60,000-ish, round numbers, so you're talking about a 12% cut in household income. That's significant.
Well, I saw something yesterday I never, ever want to see. I was at the Jewels, and there was a lady there, and she was crying. And she's like, I don't know, I can't afford that. And it was so heartbreaking. I mean, I wish, I just wish Biden would. When was the last time he went to the grocery store? Pritzker. Does he ever go to the grocery store? He's got people that do that. That they could see this kind of pain up front. I just wish to God they could, but of course that'll never happen. Because they're in a different stratosphere when it comes to money and wealth.
How it's impacting you, if you want to share any of your stories, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. James Freeman in his Best of the Web column over at the Journal is documenting some anecdotal impacts. Our retirement dreams have certainly changed since last year's two-week vacation in Hawaii. This year, we think if we scrimp and save, we may be able to afford to drive down to the DQ for a small ice cream cone we can share. A big difference. 2 weeks in Hawaii, the DQ at the corner for a small ice cream cone. Of course, you know, some of this is in terms of the cut that is particularly being felt by those who are retirees on fixed incomes.
Right.
And you're seeing the market take the hammering that it is, or even more to the point, those who are nearing retirement and that thought their retirement was going to look like one thing and they have to retrench now because they don't have the number of working years left to, you know, ride out this storm, and they've just seen their 401ks perhaps cut by 20% since January. So that's impactful too. Of course, the counter argument would be, well, you should have known and you should have seen and you shouldn't listen to politicians when you had 10 years of funny money and particularly concentrated in the last two, and you knew this was an artificial sugar high that the laws of economics were going to correct at some point sooner or later. Nick in Des Moines, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
So I have two comments real quick, or one question, I guess. First, why is it that every time I hear from these financial people or, you know, economists on whatever leftist, you know, station, like the recession is somehow always off in the distance in 2023 as opposed to happening right now? So I don't know why I keep hearing that. And then the second thought I had
is... The experts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the experts, exactly. So, like, when the quarter comes in, you know, at the end of next month or something, and then we find out we're in a recession, yeah, that'll be great. The next comment being, he's a Democrat, but I think we should have a national holiday for Joe Manchin for saving us from, like, Zimbabwean levels of inflation and being basically the only person who held the line from, you know, build back better and $7 trillion on top of what we already spent.
Thanks for the call, Nick. He definitely, Manchin, saved us a couple of points. We don't know how many because, as the May report proved, consumer price report, I don't think we've hit peak inflation yet.
No.
I don't think you can say that. And of course, over the last, the first week of June, you're seeing that certainly at the pump, where California's at $8 a gallon, and we're trending towards $7 with significant pace, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. I mean, last week we were trying to get a gallon of gas under $5. This week you're trying to get a gallon of gas under $6. But you can always go to Wisconsin. Gas right there is $4.89 a gallon, which is great because they don't have the taxes that we have here. It's unbelievable.
Something else that you heard Jared Bernstein say, too, you know, this is a global issue. It's not just an American issue. It's happening all over the world.
Is it really?
Well, of course it is. He's right. But why is that, Mr. Bernstein? Could it be that the central bankers in the Western nations all pursued the same policies? Right. Yeah, it's happening everywhere because the central bankers and the heads of state, for the most part, were all modern monetary theorists or had subscribed to that idea that you can print money without consequence. So, yes, the laws of economics apply to America as they do England and France and the rest of the world. Thank you for pointing that out, Mr. Bernstein. Republicans should be pointing that out, too. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Yeah, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I just wanted to make a statement. Yesterday I went to get gas. I got 10 gallons. It cost me $60. Mm. And before, 10 gallons only cost me $22. And there's a couple of friends of mine that have 401ks. One of them at this point has lost $55,000, and another one has lost $28,000. So these policies that this administration have is really, really hurting the American people. Have a good day. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Rich.
They're focused on the wrong things. I don't want to hear about January 6th anymore. I don't want to hear about it. But I know there's a committee hearing, so that we have to. But the American people don't care about that. American people want the gas prices to go down and the prices at the supermarket to go down.
Yeah, you don't have to hear about it, actually, if you choose not to listen. That's for sure. So Milton Friedman famously said that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon in the sense that it can be produced only by a more rapid increase in the quantity of money than in output. So that's what we saw happening. And we saw that under President Trump from the Fed, as we have Biden. But it can certainly... So I agree with Friedman. Of course, who am I to disagree with Milton Friedman?
Yeah,
but
I wouldn't know you.
But it can be exacerbated by fiscal policy. And that's the kicker that you've gotten from the Biden administration, the exacerbation of this by reckless printing of money to grow the welfare state, to increase transfer payments, to extend the pandemic for no good reason. That's the kicker you have here. So, yeah, it's a monetary phenomenon, and it's been a decade, and it's increased in pace in the last 3 years, including the last year of President Trump. However, it can be exacerbated and has been exacerbated by the fiscal policies of this administration. Tom in Oswego.
Hi, good morning, Dick and Amy. I'm a small contractor, have been for 33 years. Never seen it like this. We're experiencing supply chain problems. If we can get the materials, we're paying double what we did a year ago. You try putting in a bid for a project, and then 2 weeks later you have to increase it by 10%, and they decide not to do the project. The cost of gas, I'm fueling up over four vehicles, so we're up. We're about $8,000 a month in fuel. We used to be about $35,000. I mean, just do the math. And the thing that bothers me so much about this administration, and a lot of politicians, I see it, Democrat and Republican, they don't care. I have come to the conclusion, as long as they stay in their little power, you know, zone, they don't really care what happens as long as they get what they want. And as far as my wife and I are concerned, we're old enough where we have a nest egg. We could literally retire right now and survive. It's my children. When they have rents going up $400 in 2 months, they don't even know what they're going to do, where they're going to rent an apartment that's going up so fast. Hmm. They're the ones that are going to be crushed by this. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. Marvin, Burlington, Wisconsin. Hey, Marvin.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, how are you all? You know, it's just very simple. The price of fuel goes up, it costs more money to move everything, more money to move materials to the factories or the processing plants to produce things. And then once they're produced, more money to get them to market. I mean, I don't understand these folks who think that, oh, we just got to get rid of fossil fuels because we're all going to die in 12 years. I mean, how gullible and how stupid they are. And look at what the predicament they put us in.
According to Al Gore, really, we should already be dead.
Yeah, well, Al Gore is not a very smart individual. I mean, look at who he was vice president under. I mean, he made that choice. I mean, that shows you just his judgments. But, yeah, I mean, it's a very simple economic thing. It costs more to move things. It floats on down to everybody else, and it's not going to stop.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for the call, Marvin.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Dan and Amy, when faith and football teamed up against American democracy. When faith
like
and
it.
Football teamed up against American democracy.
I mean, the title is very provocative. I don't like it. I want to hear more.
Yeah, Sports Illustrated's Greg Bishop providing yet another case study in how the sports press corps is a facsimile of the D.C. political press corps with a bunch of people who in sports, so-called journalists, who aspire to be taken seriously, and so they fall in with the left, which is where, of course, the rest of the news press corps, political press corps finds themselves. A good example of this. This is about the case that's before the Supreme Court. It will be decided by the end of the month, as with the Dobbs decision. The case of Coach Joe Kennedy, we talked about on this show. Bremerton High School, Washington State, prayed on the field after games, wouldn't stop, was removed from his position as coach. Here's how Greg Bishop describes Kennedy in this matter, just to give you a sense of how even-handed this piece is. The coach makes for an unlikely figurehead in these legal theatrics. He was aimless most of his 53 years. For decades, he wasn't religious at all, and he isn't overtly so now. He never followed football all that closely, and yet he's now at the center of a 7-year legal conflict that started with that covenant to pray after every game. that morphed into a controversy, then a circus, then a lawsuit centered on the First Amendment and its clauses, that broadened into a political brawl, that widened into a cultural war cudgel, and that wound through the court system until case number 21-418 landed on the docket for the Supreme Court of the United States. Boy, he's really put out by Coach Kennedy and the fact that the Supreme Court decided to grant cert to this case and weigh in on it. More likely than not, weigh in it on behalf of Joe Kennedy. I mean, this column reads like a screeching protester outside of Judge Kavanaugh's home. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. The animus that Greg Bishop and, by extension, Sports Illustrated has for Christians is telling. He was aimless for most of his 53 years. I don't know if that's
true. They know that? I mean, did they talk to him?
Don't know if that's true. How is that relevant? You know, I just watched Mark Wahlberg's new movie, Father Stu.
Oh, how was it?
It was very good.
Okay.
Very good. It got very mediocre Rotten Tomatoes reviews because, of course, the artistic community also hates Christians. So there's a huge disparity between the audience score and the critic score. But as somebody who bridges that gap, as I do.
Yes. What would you give it out of 5 stars?
It's good. It's a 4+. And Mark Wahlberg, who I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of, don't think he usually has the chops to support a film by himself. And he doesn't support it by himself. You know, Mel Gibson plays his father, and he's an important figure in the film, as is his mom, the actress who plays his mom. But it's very good. But the story of Father Stu, which is a true story, is a boxer and somebody who was aimless for much of his younger life, and then finds God, and I won't tell you the whole story, but ultimately is ordained a priest. But I was just thinking about aimless for most of his 53 years.
Yeah, well,
so even if that's true, what does that have to do with your First Amendment freedom of conscience? Nothing. That's the kind of statement that somebody makes if they're looking to attack their opponent because they can't attack the merit of the case.
Yep.
And that's what you see from Greg Bishop here. But I just think this is so interesting because it's focused on youth sports. I mean, the case is. And so Greg Bishop's ire is he's offended that a football coach would pray after a game and so forth, even though I haven't seen anything from Greg Bishop or pretty much anybody else in the sports press corps about the prayer circles after NFL football games with the players from both sides, usually a handful of players at least from both sides.
Yeah, they all made it to the 50-yard line and they pray. They do that a lot.
Interesting. They haven't taken offense to that. I wonder if they're perhaps less inclined to draw the rebuke of a lot of black NFL players as opposed to some white high school football coach that they've never heard of. This is their chance to really get to what they dislike, but they can't target somebody who has a high identitarian score or who has high status that they need access to. So they go after some lowly high school football coach in Bremerton, Washington. That's an easy target. And then they can get all the poison out of their system. It's Christian nationalists. That's how Greg Bishop refers to the Sports Illustrated Report. Christian nationalists. And it's all political agenda. And it's all sort of couch language insinuating that these are theocrats and so on and so forth. Because a guy wants to say a prayer after the game and invite others to voluntarily join him if they're so inclined. The story too is so stilted. It doesn't give any quarter to the representation that Coach Kennedy has before the high court. First Liberty is the group representing him pro bono. It doesn't really get into the constitutional arguments that are being made on behalf of Coach Kennedy either. The main focus of the piece, if you read it, and I'm not suggesting you do, you've got the summary from us, is just to belittle Coach Kennedy and Christians by extension.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mm-hmm. He his just another graph from the piece to buttress my case. Does Kennedy know? Does he care? Or did he evolve to embrace playing the hero and having this large of a purpose? Maybe the political operatives who stood with him found the perfect mark, a man in search of a calling, a grand stage. They gave him the biggest theater imaginable, the Supreme Court, to further their agenda. While groups fighting for their own aims joined in, after all, football never drove Kennedy, nor did faith until more recently. But the saga of faith in football now reads like Kennedy's own Christian football movie. He's the hero, he wins, and for everyone on his side. Boy, yeah, that's so he's this aimless guy who's just sort of coasting through life, and he cracks up this grand plan. If I start praying after football games, then the administration will fire me, and then First Liberty will pick up my case, and we'll take it all the way to the Supreme Court, yeah, and sure. Then, yeah.
Sure, that's what that was the plan, yeah.
Quite the plot he cracked.
Right.
Or he cooked up. And Greg Bishop has cracked the conspiracy that Joe Kennedy is at the center of. It's just so interesting the lengths, the logical gymnastics the left will do to attack Christians and to attack people of faith, but particularly Christians, because they're a legitimate target. You don't go after Muslims. You don't go after Jews. Christians.
Game on.
Game on. Terry Rogers Park.
Hey, this last Sunday, I watched the Fox football game between New Orleans and Tampa. They had the bad taste to announce the player Tyrod Taylor wasn't there because his girlfriend just gave birth to a daughter. And that's a very inappropriate, it's very inappropriate to announce publicly unless you're married. Maybe they're trying to stamp out marriage too.
Well, okay, Terry, although I can't recommend that you watch Tampa, USFL? Yeah, USFL.
USFL? Okay.
Well, it had to be. It wasn't the Bucks and the Saints.
No, it wasn't.
Because
when Pete Tom Brady plays, we knew.
Pete in Milwaukee.
Good morning. You know, I find it interesting how they're upset about a coach just praying that his kids stay safe and not get hurt and they have a good game. And they're so against that. But if any one of these parents' kids get in a car accident or get sick, who's the first person they're going to call out to? They're going to call out to God to please heal their son or keep them safe or whatever. It's just so hypocritical. Opposite direction. It's ridiculous.
Thanks for the call, Pete. Well, it's also rank ignorance, which is nothing new from the journalistic community. But I just like to point it out because I think so many more people are interested in sports and consuming sports than they are politics and policy.
I'm just surprised that Terry's watching the USFL. She's
I'm
right.
So surprised at that, too.
I didn't even know. Sorry. Tampa
Greg
Bay
Bishop.
Yeah.
Greg Bishop's piece, you know, the subtitle, When Faith and Football Teamed Up Against American Democracy. I mean, just understand that characterization. Introducing faith or faith as a companion to sport. Hardly groundbreaking stuff, hardly new. And the clear indication is Greg Bishop and the editors at Sports Illustrated think that the introduction of faith into anything is a threat to democracy. The expected result is a win for the coach, the Supreme Court case, and the further erosion of the separation between church and state. The further erosion. Mm-hmm. First of all, as anybody well, who's ever taken a con law class knows or should know, there is no separation of church and state clause in the Constitution. If somebody would like to argue with me, then just point it out. The Establishment Clause is about establishing a state religion. It is not about expunging faith from the public square. That is like Constitution 101 stuff. But of course, that is beyond the grasp of the Greg Bishops, the sports most of the sports press corps and most of the D.C. press corps as well. And every expression of religiosity is some threat to the state. Threat to the state and threat to the people. See, that's how they have it. What they're really saying is that people of faith are a threat to the state because they're not genuflecting before the state. The state is not their church. That's what they don't like. That's what Greg Bishop doesn't like. That's what all of the other Christian haters and atheists and agnostics that populate these cultural institutions, that's what they don't like. You were supposed to make the state your God. You're your God first, and the state is your proxy God. That's what we saw during the pandemic. That's what you get in terms of argumentation. That's why you don't have a piece on the merits here, talking about faith and football and getting perspectives from both sides, because faith is so much a part of sport. That's not the piece that Greg Bishop wrote. He wrote a piece to belittle this coach, to belittle Christians, to boogeyman Christians for political reasons. It's just a political hit piece that's got the veneer of Sports Illustrated over it.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, as we are in the High Holy Month of Pride, this study that was published Friday is interesting just because the numbers are just so all over the board. This was a study put out by the Williams Institute, which is a think tank at UCLA's law school focused on gender identity public policy. Mm-hmm. And they estimate about 0.5% of all U.S. adults, 1.3 million people, and about 1.4% of young people between 13 and 17 years old identify as trans. Half a percent of U.S. adults and about 1.4% of teenagers 13 to 17. So that sort of runs into some of the other surveys, the research that's been put out there that we've discussed, like one in five, I mean, although this is just trans, but one in five Gen Zers identify as LGBTQIA, in the rainbow.
You forgot the plus.
Well, right, LGBTQIA plus, I'm sorry. So I guess, you know, you could pull that this trans number out of that study. I guess it could still be accurate. That just seems like a big jump. If it's 1.4% of youth 13 to 17 that identify as trans, it could be. But anyway, you're talking about an insular minority. And I just say that because I'm still trying to get to the oppression piece. Right, that's the whole pride and the zeitgeist and the need to mainstream it and the need to groom kids and the need to make it part of K-12 curriculum, the oppression piece. Because isn't that what the pride marches originally were conceived as, like a protest against policies that don't allow people to be themselves?
Right.
Uh-huh.
And they had a spontaneous march in Boys Town Saturday or Sunday. Sunday. Letting people know that we're...
I don't think you can call it Boys Town anymore.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's called the Halsted Business District.
Yeah.
Formerly known as Boys Town, because they wanted to, you know, they got out there just to let people know that they're sick of being oppressed, really.
Mm-hmm. And there's...
And I wanted the reporter to ask, how are you being oppressed? Like, walk me through this process. I want to know how me or anybody else is stopping you from being your true self.
Right. And there's obviously
so sick of hearing
there's no way self. There's no better way to throw off the chains of oppression than to parade down a public street with a bejeweled phallus. That's what I always say.
Stopping traffic.
Yeah, St. Charles, too. City of St. Charles Youth Commission and St. Charles Park District sponsoring a drag performer for a family-friendly event. Cultural connections, unique experiences for the St. Charles community. Family-friendly drag performer, live music, face painting, crafts, balloon arch, photo opportunities, history display, freebies, and more. That's, hey, that's tomorrow, 5:30 to 7:30. You can go over to the Baker Community Center in St. Charles and celebrate love, friendship, and individuality with your family-friendly drag performer.
In St. Charles?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Anybody heading out west to St. Charles, could I hitch a ride tomorrow to celebrate love and friendship with a family-friendly drag performer? You know, it's nice that they're doing it for the community, so it's not just for the kids anymore. You know, it's sort of unfair that it's just in the schools and then, you know, you can't bring the whole community together to enjoy family-friendly drag performances, strip shows, whatever. You know what I mean? I mean, look.
Are they going to do a show and tell where they have them get up and dance like they did in Dallas, Texas there?
You know, I'm going to defer my time on this to the eloquence of Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, okay.
Speaker Pelosi recently appeared on RuPaul's Drag Race show. This is a show where, I guess, men dress up like women. This is what the speaker had to say.
Please give a warm Drag Race welcome, Nancy Pelosi. Oh, welcome back.
My honor to be here. Your freedom of expression of yourselves in drag is what America is all about.
What words of wisdom do you have for us?
With the midterm elections coming up, it's very important for people to make their voices and their vote heard.
That sarcastic, shady clap you do was f***ing epic.
In our hearts, to keep you strong.
Can I get an amen?
Amen!
Ooh. Separation of church and state, anybody? An amen. You know, that's a show going out to the kids. They're trying to radicalize kids with Christianity. Did you hear that?
I did. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
That's awful. I mean, RuPaul should know better. Jim in St. Charles.
Hey. How's it going?
Good.
I'm so glad you brought this up.
Do you got any extra tickets? I'm looking for two.
I have no tickets, but I certainly wouldn't mind protesting this event. Hey, did you look at, maybe you should mention the sponsors. Culver's Ice Cream. Hey, let's keep going there.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
Good point.
It is nuts.
Literally.
You got to start drawing the line of who's waving the flag, and I appreciate everything you guys do. I listen to you every morning. You made my day by hearing this. I didn't know I was going to be the only one there screaming at him.
Thanks for the call. Well, you know,
I want to. You know what? I should go to the event because I just want to absorb this and see what really is going on.
Plus, you like face painting.
Well, who doesn't love a good face paint?
Exactly.
I like the tiger stripes on the right cheek, if I must.
John in Naperville.
Yeah, you know, there's a big difference between being entertained and also being indoctrinated and being forced to accept a certain lifestyle. You know, go to the Baton Club, and some of these performers are just absolutely fantastic performers and a great show. But don't force my kids to be doing stuff.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, John. Yeah, I mean, this is the whole thing. You know, and by the way, there's been, you know, a gay rights activist who've made the point that we're making. The pride thing, this like lascivious display of nudity and you know, sort of sexualized performances, you know, that you're doing that on a public street, largely in violation of public decency laws, and you easily could be charged with disorderly conduct in a different context. Doesn't that speak to the freedom that you have in this country, the lack of oppression? It's sort of your display sort of undermines your argument that there is
oppression upon your people?
Yeah. I mean, are there one-off instances of boorish behavior? And by the way, moving in a lot of different directions here. Somebody attacks somebody because they're gay or because they're trans. Does that happen? Sure, it happens. People get attacked for all sorts of different reasons all the time. It is not systemic. You're not an oppressed class. You're not deserving of special rights. You're deserving of equal rights before the law, and that's it. Just like everybody else.
But that goes by, you know, during the gay pride parade, everyone tries to out flamboyant each other and, you know, oh, I'm going to do this. Well, then I'm going to do this. And you see a lot of, you know, gyrating and twerking with women, men, trans and G-strings, and they do it on the, you know, those police ATVs. And that the last pride parade I was in was, I don't know, years ago, but I was just like, I'm done with this. This is disgusting. And kids were there, and I just thought, you know what? Not for me. Do they have a right to do it? Fine, but I'm not going to partake in it. I've seen enough. They get away with anything they want. I mean, and the cops, too, they don't like it. They're not enjoying this. They want, please move away. Please get off me. Please get off my vehicle. Get your butt out of my face, please.
Joe, Hoffman Estates.
Hey, guys. I went to a restaurant with my family, a Mexican restaurant in Schaumburg, and we were all sitting there. The place was packed. Next thing you know, they have some music playing from a DJ, and there's guys walking around dressed up like women. I mean, they're like 6'2", 200 pounds. And half the restaurants, they didn't know what was going on. By the time they started to figure it out, they started getting up and leaving. I didn't get my food yet, and I told them to take their food and stick it. I'm not paying for anything, and I won't be back. And I think the owner learned a lesson, but I didn't get a choice. Like, you can go to St. Charles or not. I'm sitting there trying to enjoy food. At this point, it's $150 to feed a family, and I don't want to be privy to this stuff.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Joe.
It's a business, though. New York City, they spent $200,000 taxpayer funds on drag story hour.
Yeah, in the public schools.
$200,000.
Well, because it's in dozens and dozens of schools. By the way, speaking of which, you know, there's something you can do about this. You know how I know? Because there's some moms in Pennsylvania doing something about this. Pennsylvania mothers file lawsuit to stop transgender lessons at elementary school. A court order to stop the gender-related instruction and offer parents the chance to excuse their children from it. So, you know, there are ways to intervene on this stuff, or at least attempt to.
Well, in New York City, the drag queens that are in your school, often without parental knowledge or consent. And that's a problem for some parents. Like, if they knew it was coming, they could yank their kids out for the day. But nope, they don't even tell them.
Dave in Central Indiana.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. How are you guys?
Morning.
Hello.
I seen your tweet, Amy, about Y Hill restaurant there in Raleigh a couple days back.
Why what?
You Libs of TikTok, you put a retweeted Y Hill restaurant in Raleigh, North Carolina.
That wasn't me, but okay, go on. What else? What about it?
Okay.
I did not tweet anything that he's referencing.
Margo and Burr Ridge.
Well, you know, I almost called with the last discussion, but this kind of ties into it too. John Adams said, our Constitution was designed for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate for any other. And, you know, that is kind of what they're trying to get us away from. And so here's another quote from the Bible, Proverbs 22. The child in the way that he should go. When he is old, he will not depart from it. So I know these people claim they don't read the Bible, but they're kind of practicing that. They're trying to change our populace into this amoral, really sex-obsessed, you know, type of populace. And
yes,
that's
Caligula.
What all this is. Yeah, I mean, that's what they're trying to lead us to, the end of the empire, I guess. That's how the Romans ended. Anyway, that's all I had to say, but that's what I keep thinking.
Thanks for the call, Margo. Yeah, the whole... A just and virtuous people line from Adams. You know, there's something sort of fundamental. What he's referring to in part is knowledge of where from where your rights are derived. What is the source of your rights? The Almighty, the Bill of Rights, negative restraints on government, so that people are able to enjoy their natural rights that come from God. And if you don't understand that, then you sort of miss everything else. If you get the foundation wrong, then you get all of the conclusions wrong. That's what he's talking about. You don't know where your rights come from? You think your rights come from the state? Well, then everything, you know, then you're going to view everything through that prism. And if you understand that your rights come from God, individual rights come from God, then you're going to view things from that prism. And the viewpoints are very distinct. What you see is very distinct. And the results also are very distinct. David and McCook.
Hey, good morning, Dan. I'm 6 foot, about 230, so I went and bought a size 16 dress and a long green wig. I was wondering what time you want me to pick you up.
You know, so it's 5:30. I'll be coming from the city, Dave. So, you know, if we want to get there for the face painting, you're probably going to have to grab me about 4:15. Does that work?
That'll work.
Thanks, Dave. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Chris Butler is a pastor, an organizer of the AND campaign and candidate for Congress in Illinois' 1st Congressional District, South Side. That's the old Bobby Rush district. He's retiring. Good riddance. And it's an open seat. Chris Butler running in a crowded Democrat field for the nomination and basically for the seat. The primary is the general. He's endorsed by the FOP. Oh, endorsed by the, those are scarlet letters in a Democrat primary, FOP.
Oh, that's good.
Well, is it? Chris Butler joins us now. Chris, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much, Dan and Amy, for having me on.
Why have you yet to repudiate your endorsement by the FOP? You're running in a Democrat primary.
I am running in a Democrat primary, but, you know, I am a person who's grown up in this city. Folks, if you don't know it, I am a black man. I know the difficulty that's been in the relationship sometime between the police and the public, but it's a relationship that we absolutely have to make work. And so I'm very proud to have the support of the Fraternal Order of Police because it says something that's really important to say right now, Dan, and that is that we need to support our police officers. We have police being attacked basically on a daily basis almost. And I think that it's not caused by, but it's certainly not helped by sort of equivocal language from our leaders. So I'm very proud of this endorsement.
And just yesterday,
and
a Chicago cop, and just yesterday, a woman was laying naked in the street. Chicago cop tried to help her. She stole his car and then ran over the officer. So
yeah,
I mean,
and these things are happening more and more frequently. And somebody's got to stand up and say, this is wrong. We can't attack police officers on the streets. We have to support our police. We have to work together with them, because if we're going to be serious about families, we got to be serious about public safety. And while some people are pushing this delusion that we can do public safety without police, that's not a reality. And so we have to work together with the police. We have to support our police. So that we can make our community safe.
So why is the FOP endorsing you? What did they say? Why they chose you over the many other candidates that are running?
Most of the other candidates will be part of that chorus of equivocating voices that won't clearly say we need to support our police and that we need police as part of the public safety infrastructure. There is a louder and louder sort of delusion that's been pushed that somehow we can actually create public safety without our police. And the more leaders are pushing that, the more folks buy into that, we're seeing that our communities are becoming less and less safe. And so I think the FOP chose me because I'm absolutely not part of that chorus. I think that what we need in this Democratic primary is somebody who's going to be able to challenge our party leaders when we're doing the wrong thing, when we want to get caught in distractions, and be able to work across the aisle so that we can get practical things done for working families. And I think the FOP endorsement suggests that I'm the one with the background experience to do those things. And as I've said a lot, anybody who can't challenge party leaders and can't work across the aisle, when they tell you anything else that they're going to get done in Congress, they're either deluded about how Congress works or they're absolutely just lying to folks, knowing that they can't get anything done because they refuse to challenge our own leadership. They refuse to work across the aisle. And so they just are willing to tell untruths to people. You got to be able to do these things in order to be successful in Congress. I mean, it'll be closely divided. A lot of folks think it'll be a Republican Congress. And if you don't have those skills, you won't be able to represent the first district well.
Well, you sound like a Republican. Why aren't you running as one?
Yeah, a lot of folks, you know, suggest that I sound like a Republican. I've been in Democratic politics all of my life. The first Democrat sort of precinct captain that I volunteered with was my great aunt Irene when I was probably about 12 years old. I believe that this party has been and can be again a big tent party where folks can come together from a lot of different persuasions and worldviews and work hard to make sure that we get things done for working families.
Go on.
I don't want to be pushed out of the party. You know, my own personal family and my people have invested a lot in these families. And one thing that folks don't know is that the values that I learned and that I believe, I learned them in my community from my mother, my grandmother, the pastor of the black church that I now lead myself. This is where I learned my values. I didn't go outside the community to learn them. The problem is that these values have been pushed down because of the tremendous amount of money that has been put into our politics to prop up voices that want to pull us away from these values.
Now, who is your biggest challenger right now? Is it Jackson? I mean, you have so many different people running for this seat.
There are so many people in this seat, and I think because of that, because you have folks with names and, folks already in, elected office and part of the sort of machine that has overseen the decline of our community, is actually a wide open race. And it's an opportunity for us to actually do something really special here. It's why I'm glad that you all have let me come on this show, because I'm reminding people in these last 14 days what Evan Burke said. The only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men and women to do nothing. And so I'm really encouraging folks to go to electchrisbutler.com and make contributions, sign up to volunteer, because we have a real shot at doing this. It's a 17-way race. And if you want a pro-abortion candidate, you got a bunch of folks to choose from. Only one is going to stand up for preborn life. If you want folks who are going to try to tank and sink and set up our police, you got a bunch of folks to choose from. Only one of us has been endorsed by the FOP. And on down the line, there are a lot of ways that I stand out from the other candidates, and I think that gives me a great shot in this 17-way primary.
Will you, Chris, will you commit here on this show today in conjunction with your friends at FOP to find Bobby Rush's popcorn and return it to him safely?
We will do our very, very best.
All right.
That caper has never been solved.
No, it's unsolved. He goes
out of office without knowing who ate half of his bag of popcorn.
I don't think the city can heal until that popcorn is returned, to be honest with you. Chris, with respect to the larger landscape, too, as somebody who's running and maybe representing the first congressional in Congress come January, what is your larger take on the city of Chicago, the upcoming mayor's race? Where do you think the city stands? And for somebody who's running to represent a majority black district, where does the city stand and where do black families stand in the city?
Yeah, we need a lot of change in the city. We need to begin to refocus on the fabric of family and community, which really I think is the only way that we're going to preserve our values and our communities that folks have invested, generations on building up the south side of Chicago. It's one of the most historic black places in the United States. And if we don't reinvest in the infrastructure of family and community, we won't be able to preserve that. Now, I believe that the government needs to come alongside and support families, create the environment for family and community to work and to prosper. But when we you know, just look around at the erosion of these basic values of family and community. It's a huge problem for the city. I think for the country is why I'm running for Congress, and I think we need change across the board.
Do you think that the possible constituents you talk to, the voters now, possibly future constituents you talk to, you think they're ready for real talk about broken families, fatherlessness, crime and criminal records, doing the things that one needs to do to be a successful, productive citizen?
The funny thing, Dan, is that when I go around and I'm talking to folks at the doors and sitting in barbershops and visiting churches, this conversation is happening. What we have in our community right now is that folks really from outside of the community have dumped so much money into our politics and into other areas of our culture to prop up these voices, which are actually minority voices within the community, but they're propped up with so much money that it seems like the conversation is not happening, but it's actually happening all over the community. It's just been pushed down under the weight of the tremendous amount of money that's been dumped into our campaigns and into other areas of our culture. And it's happening in this race. Tons and tons of money. You know, it's split up because there are so many candidates, but tons of money, again, been dumped in from really wealthy people outside of the community to prop up voices that, for the most part, don't sound like what I hear in the barbershops, in the churches, and on the doorstep when I'm out here knocking on doors.
Mr. Butler, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay.
Did I go out?
We're still here. tell me about how being a pastor has helped you communicate with people in your community and knowing what their needs are.
You know, being a pastor has me walking alongside families. You know, I pastor, I remind people I don't pastor, you know, like a big, huge mega church. I pastor a mid-sized family church, about 200 and something people. Mm-hmm. And so you get to walk alongside families. There are police officers in my church, nurses and single moms and folks who are living everyday life. And as a pastor, on a regular basis, you get to sit with folks in their most intimate and sometimes difficult situations and really understand what people are going through. And it helps to see sort of a microcosm of the community through pastoring the church.
Are you the only Democratic candidate that's pro-life?
Since we've been in this campaign, I think a few folks have in forums suggested that they are also pro-life. But I did come in that way. But I think that it's important to have a pro-life Democrat because we need to be able to bring that conversation to the forefront.
Dan, are you back?
Yes. Am I going?
Okay. So,
can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. So for more information, we'll go to electchrisbutler.com. That's electchrisbutler.com.
Hey, Chris, hold on a second. I got one more question for you. I dropped out for a second. Yeah. We had a little technical glitch. Just going back to what you were saying about the conversations happening, and you talked about all the money being dumped into, you know, the politics in communities like yours. But the problem is that the evidence suggests that's the only thing that works because that's the only thing that generates electoral success. Where is the evidence that something other than, you know, Marshall Plan for the South Side, mandating these wages and putting more money into these programs, where's the evidence that anything other than that rap works?
Well, I mean, that rap has actually not worked outside of the money being dumped in. And I think that we need to demonstrate, we got an opportunity to demonstrate in this election that we can bring common sense values, policies, and approaches, and win elections and gain leadership in the community. I do think that it is it's necessary to build a grassroots movement that will include people of goodwill from outside of the community, just like folks who want to tank our community are putting their mighty resources into tanking our community. I think if folks who are listening to your show, Dan, can put even meager resources together with the kind of volunteer energy that we have going in this campaign, we can prove the ability to win this election. And I think that'll make a map and begin to turn the tide, because that's what we need, is actual change in our community, in our nation. And I think we have to build that model right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. You got to put a marker down. Here's an opportunity. ElectChrisButler.com. ElectChrisButler.com is where you get more information on Chris and his candidacy and campaign. He's a pastor, organizer of the AND campaign, and candidate for the Democrat nomination for Congress in Illinois 1, Illinois' 1st District. Chris, thanks for joining us. Good luck on June 28th.
Thank you all so much for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Talked about this Biden economic advisor's comments a little bit earlier in the show, but we want to get our next guest to comment. So here's Jared Bernstein. He's part of the White House Council of Economic Advisors for the big guy. He was on Squawk Box with the normally insufferable Andrew Ross Sorkin, but even Sorkin couldn't tolerate everything that Bernstein was shoveling his way on inflation.
Absolutely, because, well, first of all, we're having an inflationary story in every advanced economy in the globe, and in fact, inflation is historically elevated everywhere. So it's certainly not just one country's fiscal or monetary policy.
But then the question is, what did the White House miss? And what's the lesson of that?
I don't think the White House missed much at all in the...
For reaction, we're pleased to be joined by Scott the Cow Guy Shelody. Scott, who is a market specialist for Market Day Report at RFD-TV. And you also got your own show. Scott,
yeah.
Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning. Give us your promo on your own show. What's your
it's,
show?
It's 1 Central, 2 Eastern every day on RFD-TV. It's called The Cow Guy Close. We wrap up the day's events.
There it is.
There you go.
And so they didn't miss much, and it's happening everywhere. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, I mean, that's great. That's a good excuse. You know, look, Mom, everybody else is doing it too. All right. Well, that's ridiculous. But I think that the unique thing here that everybody misses is, yes, sir. You know, not everybody's ever come out of a 100-year pandemic before. I'm not a total a jerk on this. I understand that there were some different things that we hadn't ever experienced before. But my biggest problem is this. We are in a unique situation than everybody else around the world where we can solve our own problems, because 60 to 70% of our inflation problem is energy-based. And if we took care of our energy problem, we'd be way, way down when it comes to inflation. But because they've ignored that, I mean, and we could also be helping our friends too, by the way, with LNG and the likes. So we are the ones on the airplane, the masks have come down and we just sit there and don't put them on. Let alone putting ours on and helping others. I mean, it's ridiculous. So we are uniquely placed to help ourselves, and they just won't do it.
But how the hell did we get here? I mean, this is prices, obviously gas prices. When you go to the grocery store, people, I told Dan earlier, a lady was crying at the grocery store yesterday because she didn't have enough money to pay for her groceries. And it's a horrible part. It's not just a horrible place to be, but this is not the America that we want to be living in right now.
No, and because we're like everybody else, number one, I can't stand it either. But a large part of those food increases is due to transportation, getting them around. You know, look what just happened to Walmart and Target. They got surprised by the shipping costs, right? They shouldn't have. But John Katsimatidis, he's a big, big oil refiner, a billionaire oil refiner on the East Coast. He's from New York. He also owns a lot of small grocery stores in New York. Mm-hmm. And he looked at the camera 2 days ago over the weekend and said, somebody's trying to destroy our country.
Wow.
Bottom line. And so here we sit. I just can't stand the fact that it's underneath our feet. And even just making moves towards taking it out from underneath our feet would give people relief automatically because crude oil prices would tumble on the exchanges. But they don't want to do that. They want to have this revolution, this energy revolution. When you have a revolution, that means you didn't make the sale to the constituents. You're forcing them to do something. And by forcing them to do something, they're reluctant to embrace this wind and solar, which, by the way, is a totally different energy than what we have with fossil fuels because you can't store it and it's intermittent. Fossil fuels is there when you need it. And you can't compare those. They're not fungible. You can't replace one with the other. You just can't. We're nowhere near being able to do that. But they're forcing us one way, and that's making everybody not like where we're going. And the businesses that used to be involved with fossil fuel know that they're not going to get any support from anybody, so they're like, you know what? We're not going to push out the boat here. We're not spending any money on research and development. We're not going to put, you know, make these refineries work again. We're going to sit here and enjoy the high prices. Because you know what? You don't have our backs. We don't trust you. And they can't. I mean, they're being banks are being discouraged from loaning money to fossil fuel companies. Wow. There are hedge funds that have taken oaths around the world to not invest in fossil fuel companies. I don't blame those people for being angry.
Yeah, I mean the ESG movement on top of the green energy revolution, and so you know I suppose when you read the estimates from Moody's and it says $5,500 hit that that Americans are taking on average this year with the inflationary with the inflation, and you know that's an 8% haircut for the median household income in this country. That's a big cut, but you know that's the median. I mean, who cares about the middle income and lower income families as long as those at the top continue to enjoy the revolution?
Yeah, well, think about it, Dan. I mean, those you know, look, we in these bigger metropolises, these bigger cities around America, we all know that it's cheaper to live further out away from the city, right? Because it's just too expensive to live downtown for a lot of people. So you've got a lot of these workers that have to drive a long way to get to work because they've chosen to live further out because they could. Gas was $2.50 a gallon. And they've made that decision because it was way cheaper for their housing. Well, now these people can't afford it anymore. They can't afford to get to work anymore, or they're having to make really bad choices about whether they feed the family or put gas in the tank. I mean, and this is the situation. I mean, where did you ever think that we were going to have a food shortage for children? I mean, this has gotten to the most ridiculous point where you could throw darts at a dartboard and be right more often. This has been every single turn he's been wrong. That is almost statistically impossible. He has to have made a mistake and gotten something right, but he hasn't.
Well, and here we're still, although this isn't happening as broadly as it should, but in terms of root causes, we are still making assessments about the impact. We know it was on net negative, and that's also something that won't be conceded, but the depths of the negativity associated with the lockdowns.
Well, I mean, I'm on record. I had death threats. You know, I escaped to Scottsdale in the middle of it all, but I said the unintended consequences of lockdowns will be felt for maybe 20, maybe longer, because 20 years or longer, because this, that was, and all you had to do was do a little bit of research, Dan and Amy, and I looked up probably four or five government white papers at the time while I was sitting by myself at 2 in the morning in Scottsdale wondering where my career was going. Was I committing Harry Caray? Because I was a lone voice saying, this is wrong, do not shut the economy down. Because all of these white papers were written outside of the pandemic or the pandemia, right, the hysteria, and when everybody had cooler heads, and all of them talked about what they should not do. And most often, one or two of the top two reasons was don't lock your economy down. It doesn't work. You know, give people personal responsibility, give them the best tools, let them make the decisions. But no. We had cases in Indiana where it was okay to get your hair cut on one side of the road and not, it was illegal on the other. I mean, that's not my, I mean, you could get arrested for walking to a park with a mask on in Chicago by yourself. Mm-hmm. Are you kidding me? That's where we went to. And people, remind yourselves how ridiculous it was. Yep. Walking through a restaurant with a mask on, sitting down at your table and taking it off because that's okay. Remind yourselves how they conned and lied. It's unbelievable. The more I think about it, the more angrier I get.
I know. And they locked, shut down, she shut down the lakefront in every park. So we couldn't even be outside to walk.
And, right. And, the,
and
the
papers
results,
in our car, so in case we got pulled over. We
the results. Passed. The results. And the results that we know is that lockdown economies did not have better health outcomes. Open schools were slightly negatively correlated with health outcomes, but you're talking about a population that was not particularly vulnerable in kids. The lockdowns of schools and economy is highly correlated. If you lock down one, you lock down the other. So, it seems to me we got to remember what all of what you guys are describing actually produced too, which is just nothing but negativity. And as I said, now we're measuring the depths and the duration.
And to make everybody feel better, they got bailed out, with trillions of dollars that was thrown at an economy that absolutely, when it finally did open up, was gangbusters. So you had gasoline poured on a fire. And now we wonder how we had inflation. They overcompensated because they stole your rights. And by the way, they didn't really steal them. A lot of people just handed them over for this idea of safety.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, anybody that is happy with a universal basic income or these 25 to 45-year-olds that we quite happy to sit around for 50 or 60 grand a year, they've signed over all their hopes, and they've sold their hopes and dreams to the government for 50 grand a year. That's not my America. I can't believe it.
And so when do you think, are we at the worst point right now, or is it going to get worse before it gets better?
We got a number here that looks like it might get worse this morning, producer price inflation. It probably will get a little bit worse here before. I mean, we're getting to the point now, Dan and Amy, that people don't have any money to spend anymore because everything's so expensive. So higher prices have cured higher prices because everybody's broke.
Yeah, well, that COVID relief money that everybody was so happy to get turned out to be a one-way ticket to Palookaville. On the market, though, I'm just looking at this historically. Did you like my On the Waterfront reference? Thank you.
Right.
Our friend Jim Perry over at Arbor Research charts this. So far, it looks like an average correction. If you look at Jan to May 9th, S&P's off about 17%, so it's 127 days. So that's about median if you look at corrections over the last, since World War II. So that's the data. And what's your expectation about where we go from here? I'm not talking about just today, but sort of give us broader perspective for the next calendar year.
I'm a little bit more negative on the market still yet. But we're getting close. I would agree that. But I don't think we're going to have a snapback this time, Dan, because you can go to those, whomever that person was you just cited, if you can go to those numbers, and I totally agree. However, we have seen historic synthetic tightening or historic synthetic rate rises because everything has gone up in price. Not the general electorate has not just lost their 401ks and the stock market and been uncomfortable. They have been decimated in all other parts of their own home economies, like never before. And then on top of it, they're raising rates even more. So your mortgage is going up. Every time you get your wallet out, it's going to be something that's going to be more expensive. That is historic tightening that we have never seen before in every aspect of everybody's lives. So on top of the average, downdraft in the stock market, everybody's broke.
Yeah, and so where do you put what you've got left of your nest egg? It doesn't look like crypto may be the bet right now either. So obviously high risk assets are also taking a hammering. I mean, where do you go? You go to cash and gold? What do you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it'll ultimately pan out to be a normal, at some point in time, it'll be a normal inflationary situation. And I think that, own assets that hurt when you drop them on your foot, the old adage, and I think that would probably be the case, because people are going to need to, eat, and people are going to need to live in a house or something, right? So those types of things. But we're not there yet. I mean, right now we're to this wholesale washout where your 401k is gone, and oh, by the way, you can't make it to work. And we're getting to that point where gas is so expensive that, it doesn't matter how expensive it is now, I don't have a job. Wait till you see the unemployment start to tick up here. That's starting to happen. It started to happen 6 weeks ago. We had our first little inkling of it. But you're going to start to see big job losses here because these companies have not managed, because of supply chains, they've not managed their inventories. So it all comes in fits and starts. And now they've got a bunch of spring stuff on sale because it didn't get here in time. Wait till you see these wholesale liquidations, and then you know they're going to start. You know they'll start with hiring freezes, then they'll start cutting your hours, and then they're going to start cutting you.
We used to talk with you when we talked about the unemployment number, and it sort of doesn't mean anything the way that it's calculated in terms of what it's supposed to indicate. I'm almost thinking that the word recession doesn't mean anything anymore either, because we're arguing about whether or not, you know, 2 quarters of negative growth is a recession, whether we'll see negative growth in Q2 or not, and whether we're going to be in recession or going to be in recession in the last year. But everything you're describing and everything we're hearing about where people are at, you can call it a recession or not call it a recession. People are in a bad way.
And that's 100% true. And I think you can take a lot of those old rules and old words and throw them out the window, because we could see a negative growth quarter this quarter, right, at the end of June. And if that's the case, technically we're in a recession. But then how can we be technically in a recession with 3.6% unemployment and 11 million jobs looking for people to fill them? I mean, something doesn't make sense here. I just hope I live another 25 years so I can figure it all out, because right now it's not making sense at all. These JOLTS numbers, these job openings numbers of 11, 11.5 million jobs that are open versus 6 million people looking for jobs and a 3.6% unemployment rate, it doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense.
So, I mean, is it people being propped up by government benefits and believing they have more leverage in the employment market than they do?
And savings, which is plummeting, and credit card debt, which is skyrocketing.
Yeah, yeah.
Great world we live in.
Well, because everybody thinks it's short term. Let me tell you, I don't think we're going to get snapped back in the markets like everybody thinks we did, like after 2020 in the market, snapped back real hard. And we could just bump along at 4, 5, 7, 8% growth. And that's going to change when you've got everything on credit cards and you have no savings.
Mm. Scott the Cowguy Shelady, he's a market specialist for Market Day Report on RFD TV. Also, he's got his own show, Cowguy Close, 1 p.m. Chicago time on RFD TV. Scott Shelady, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
All right, guys, thanks.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out. I said, when you're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That theme music means it's time for our weekly conversation with Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. And I know we're going to talk inflation, but I want to talk energy first. And this is something Jeannie Ives has been bringing up and others, too, over the last few weeks. I think Darren Bailey brought it up on the campaign trail, too. The fact that Illinois is pursuing the Pyongyang model for its electricity grid. Southern Illinois is among the most vulnerable places in the country heading into the summer, according to a newly published forecast by the North American Electric Reliability Corp. The area, Southern Illinois, along with large parts of Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and other states linked to the regional grid, has been put on notice in the forecast that it is facing a high risk of energy emergencies during peak summer conditions. A major reason is that some of the coal plants that regulators assumed would keep running for another year or two are instead coming offline. Some plant operators are choosing to shut down rather than invest in upgrades for coal plants that do not fit with the state's and federal government's long-term goals for clean energy. The economics aren't great, so coal plant operators are saying uncle, was the quote from the chief executive of that regulatory authority. This is the Washington Post reporting. And Mark Lennon over at Wirepoints did a nice write-up on this. So we were just talking to Scott Shelady about oil and gas companies not producing because they know that as soon as the crisis subsides, they'll be right back to facing antagonism from federal and state, federal and in some states, also state policymakers. And so why should I make CapEx investments when I know you're antagonistic towards my company's and my sector's existence per the ESG movement and the backdoor Green New Deals that are afoot, including under the leadership of one Governor Spaulding in Illinois. Turning off the lights in Southern Illinois this summer. That will be interesting. Ted, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Hi, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Yeah, so we talk about it at the federal level because of, you know, oil and gas and what could be done with respect to federal energy policy. But we have a conversation that's a microcosm of what's happening at the federal level right here in Illinois.
Yeah, I don't think you can ignore what's happening locally. And you know, there's a lot of people that need to be held accountable for this. And if we get brownouts, a lot of people should be held accountable. You know, and most people immediately jump and think about energy costs and think federal policy. But there's a lot that goes on right here. And Governor Pritzker, of course, has led in about as strong a way as you can nationally for a state leader. Taking on the fossil fuels and, of course, pushing the green energy. And, you know, we'd argue that it's just been so, you know, they're going full speed on this transition with no plan. We talked about that like a couple of weeks ago. There's been no plan. We FOIA'd Governor Pritzker for his plan on how he's going to convert to, you know, 50% green energy by 2040 and 100% by 2050. And they couldn't send us anything. They sent us some gobbledygook. Yeah, this is a big deal. And if we start to have brownouts, which is what they're warning about in Southern Illinois, that's a big deal. And that's because of the really bad rhetoric and of course, the law changes that are attacking the fossil fuels and just going too fast in terms of a dependency on clean energy.
I'd like somebody to ask Governor Spaulding if he's ever pumped gas.
I know. I was, or gone
has
to the grocery store.
Well, walked. He's ever been to a grocery store. He doesn't have to walk. I don't want to break in his legs. But, yeah, I would just wonder.
Yeah, I will ask him. Well, let's talk about that because recently went to Wisconsin. Gas was $4.89. And as soon as you drive over that border, you see a sign for gas that was $5.45. It's just ridiculous. What could Governor Pritzker be doing right now, Ted, to alleviate some of the pain at the pump?
Well, the first thing is, you know, we have a sales tax on gasoline. It's 6.25%. For the state, and then you've got all the other municipalities and counties that can charge their own sales tax. So none of them in their budgets had planned on gas at $5 and $6 and $7 a gallon. So what they should do is, you know, it's a simple one, to say we're not going to impose a sales tax on anything above $2, $2.50, whatever the number is, and then that would give some relief. It's not big, I mean, given the massive increases in gas prices, but, you know, you throw back 15 cents to people, that's worth something, and then you know, on this motor fuel tax, you got to remember that Governor Pritzker doubled the motor fuel tax from 19 cents to 38 cents. And he did that because we have this capital plan of $45 billion. Well, when they did that plan, I don't think they knew that the federal government was going to do their own massive trillion infrastructure plan. $17 billion of that comes to Illinois. Scale back your capital plan, lower your motor fuel tax. So, you know, you can probably give back 30 cents right off the bat to Illinois. That's not huge, but it would be something. But of course, don't count on him to do that because that would never fit in his plans.
Well, the doubling of the state gas tax that he did that. And we need Pritzker stickers on the gas pumps too, not just Biden stickers. The argument will be, well, that was to fund a big capital bill, and if you remove the dedicated funding source for the capital bill, then you don't get those capital improvements. How do you respond to that?
Well, no, but we're getting $17 billion of infrastructure spending from the federal government as well, and that wasn't counted on. So, $62 billion, that's massive in terms of capital expenditures, and not to mention many of those are just pork to keep a lot of people, a lot of politicians happy. So a lot of that could be scaled back. There's a lot of waste there. You know that a lot of the people who are negotiating this bill, the late Senator Sandoval, they're all busted for stuff like this. The corruption in Illinois is massive, and you know it plays out in capital bills like this. So you can easily scale this back.
Totally. And, you know, golly gee, I would, you know, cry a river of tears for these politically connected rogue contractors if their wire deals were interrupted at all. Speaking of which, I don't know if you've heard this. I don't think this has bubbled to the surface yet, but Local 150, the operating engineers, are staging a strike against the big three quarry owners. That would be Hansen, Vulcan, and Lafarge. That impacts a few hundred of their members, but the bigger problem is if the quarries shut down, that will idle thousands of operators, and it will also potentially shut down all that work you see going on in the tollway and the expressways, local road work in communities around the Chicagoland area, cement yards, asphalt plants, many private sector projects. Well, that would be a moment, wouldn't it, if we saw all of that infrastructure come to a halt because of a Local 150 strike against the quarry owners. I mean, and it's also sort of if this comes to pass and goes on long enough to have this sort of extended impact, you know, the pebble in the pond sort of ripple effect. But it also is another great example or case study in, you know, sort of supply chain and the interconnectedness of things.
Well, you know, I saw it pop up in the news, and so it's real. A lot of confusion about who's blaming whom for the strike. But I think, you know, when you look at all the things that go on, and, you know, we got critiqued the other day for not bringing up some positive things in Illinois, and, you know, we struggled to think about what those might be. But this would just be another mismanagement of an economy that should be, you know, one of the strongest, biggest, fastest, whatever you want to call it, in the country. And yet, you know, everywhere you go and you touch things, we just talked about brownouts, right? We have our own hand in inflation. Illinois policy creates a lot of that inflation or supports it. And then you've got things like this potential strike and creating more of a mess. It's a real mismanagement of Illinois. And, it does lend itself to thinking about, don't you need somebody who understands a little bit how the real world works? And I don't think we have that today.
Yeah. No, you wrote a fascinating article about breakfast costs and what they were, 2 years ago compared to right now?
That's right. That's fascinating. You know, I was thinking to myself, well, you know, if you go out and eat right now, you see how much it costs. I mean, prices have really, really jumped for a hamburger and whatever. So you might think, well, I'm just going to stay at home and feed myself and save money. But if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics reporting on prices, you realize that your breakfast, your own breakfast, if you're prepared at home, is up almost 50% compared to 2 years ago. You know, you look at bacon, bacon's up 38%. Eggs are up 75%. It used to be 164 for a dozen, now it's 286. That's 75%. Your coffee per pound is up 31%. So, you know, you sit down and try to have your own breakfast, and it's costing you a lot more. Then, of course, you get in your car to go to work, then you got to pay that gas price, which is up, you know, more than 150% now. And then if you had to buy a new car, used car to travel, well, you got to pay 51% more. It's crazy. And you know, to cap it all off, hourly earnings in the country are only up 8%. And when you adjust for inflation, they're actually negative six. So you're getting hammered if you're just the ordinary Joe, ordinary Jane, just trying to make ends meet, because you're not making more money, you're actually making less. And everything is costing, you know, these 20 and 30 and 40 and 50% more.
And it's important, again, that the policy perspective in D.C. right now from the White House is the same as the policy perspective from the governor's mansion here.
Well, this is the thing. You know, you look for who to blame. And I think we've got to hold people accountable for this mess, right? We can't have people get away with bad behavior, bad policy. And it's easy to think about the federal government or to try to blame Putin or China for the supply chain issues. But right here in Illinois, you know, you've got the lockdown policies were one of the biggest impacts on supply chain issues. And who led the country in lockdowns? Illinois. Governor Pritzker's policies were some of the strictest in the country. Wallet Hub and groups like that came out and said Illinois was the strictest. So we helped create that supply chain issue here in Illinois. And many of us oppose those lockdowns for the obvious reasons you guys talked about in your last segment. Here in Illinois, we were the biggest supporter of the $1 trillion bailouts. You know, we were the first state to beg for money when Don Harmon begged for $42 billion in cash back in April of 2020. And last thing is, you know, we talked about this green energy. We're pursuing this green energy so fast that we're making a mess of Illinois. So we're helping President Biden with his agenda to go so haphazardly, so fast that it's making a mess of the country.
And so, and, you know, positive steps that could be taken, even if there's not much positive occurrences to report. We mentioned the repeal of the sales tax or above a certain number, a certain gas price, repealing the Pritzker doubling of the gas tax, you know, putting a halt at minimum and full reverse would be better to these Green New Deal gambits. Is there anything else you would like to hear from state legislators or the governor that, you know, this is something that could alleviate some of the financial pressure that the larger economic environment is imposing?
Well, you know, I think what we have to do is be careful that we let both at the national level and at the local level, Illinois level, we don't want little short-term things because that's not the problem. Yes, we're having a very acute problem right now because of the crisis, but just because those acute problems go away doesn't mean that Illinois is all better. Right, we have the second highest property taxes, the second highest gas taxes. I could go on and on. We need structural changes, and so we don't need just a little bit of support on the gas. We don't need just a little bit of support on this inflation stuff. What we need is structural reform. Otherwise, Illinois was bad beforehand economically. We're going to be even worse, and I think people will continue to flee the state. Structural is what we need.
He is Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. As Rod Dreher says, we are in the high holy month of pride. And it's great to see Fox News getting into the act. They did a report over the weekend on the Whittington family, Raising Ryland Whittington.
Yeah, his mom wrote a book. I watched the story. I was offended. But
here's how that went.
Only walking down the street, you wouldn't think anything different.
14-year-old Ryland Whittington is a typical Southern California teenager. And the Whittingtons, along with mom Hillary, dad Jeff, and sister Brinley, are a typical family. The only difference, though, in Ryland's eyes, is what this family can mean to the tens of thousands of kids under 18 who identify as transgender.
We put our story out there so people could see that, like, there's another family out there that is going through what we're going through, or there's another family who's proud of who they are.
Before Ryland could even speak, he managed to tell his parents that he is a boy.
I could just see that it wasn't him trying to be a brat. It was like painful. It was truly painful for him to have to wear feminine clothing and for us constantly telling him that you're a girl.
And unlike some trans kids, when Ryland came out at age 5 a few years later, he had the full support of his parents.
Initially, there was some pushback from us in trying to understand this.
We were confused like most people are. We thought that gender and sexuality were the same thing. It took us a while to figure out that those two things are different and that children actually do recognize their gender identity very young. Some of them, not all.
But they listen to Ryland and to Hillary's conservative faith.
For me, it's just a deep spiritual belief that you believe in God and he, you know, created us the way he wanted us. Well, then yes, he created Ryland just the way he is.
And they listened to families. They met in support groups.
There was a father who was sitting across the table. He says, "You have no idea how lucky you are to be here," which kind of took me back. I didn't at that point consider myself lucky to be there. And he said, you know, our child had displayed this gender dysphoria or this gender misalignment at the same age that Ryland has. And we didn't listen, and we pushed back.
That pushback led that child to turn to self-harm as a teenager, which 60% of trans and non-binary kids engage in, according to the Trevor Project. More than 50% consider suicide.
That, for me, was the turning point. I didn't want to see Rylan to go through that.
I'd rather have a living son than a dead daughter. And I guarantee that if we had pushed back and done what a lot of parents do, I don't think that we would have either one of the kids that you see before you here today.
Allowing him to live authentically and true to himself and be who he really feels like he is. When you get to know Rylan, you see just how proud and confident he is of himself.
Mm-hmm. And then the reporter, Brian Giannis, if I'm saying his name right, had this to say to Dana Perino to summarize this piece that he put together you just heard.
What extraordinary courage displayed by Ryland, his sister Brinley, father Jeff, and mom Hillary. I want to thank the Whittington family for speaking to us. It's not easy, particularly at a time when transgender issues have been politicized. People are afraid of what they do not understand, Dana. This family hopes their story will lead to more understanding, more acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Matt Walsh, the documentarian of the recent offering, What is a Woman? He tweeted this. Today, Fox ran a long segment for Pride Month celebrating a trans kid who came out as a boy at the age of 5. The piece did not simply report on the controversy surrounding child transitioning. It outright promotes the practice. The reporter says that the child announced a new gender as a toddler. Does Fox want us to believe that babies can choose their gender? This is the most extreme, radical, dangerous form of gender ideology, and it's being promoted on Fox. He went on to say, I've appeared on Fox News many times. I appreciate the platform they've given me. If what I'm about to say ruins the relationship, so be it. We have to call this evil lunacy out wherever we see it, especially on our own side. And Amy, you thought that was a wonderful story.
Well, I didn't like the tag when he said, you know, that transgender is under attack, you know, where... But the story, I mean, she's a conservative woman. I don't know if she's Republican or not. She said she's a conservative. The reporter said that, too.
Well that's good enough for me.
No. It's clearly the girl has always felt that she has been a boy. But doing it at the age of 5, I would probably wait later until, you know, addressing that, if that's a real issue. But, you know, I got to tell you, we have a foster son. And when I went to Lawrence Hall to... You know, many times there are so many transgender kids that have been abandoned by their parents, and it's really heartbreaking, and they need to be loved and they want to be loved just like everybody else. And their parents kicked them out of the house.
Yeah. That's a false binary. That's a false binary.
What do you mean a false binary? It's a fact. I wouldn't make this stuff up. I mean, it's not the entire, it's one wing of an orphanage.
It's a false binary, and I'll explain, just as the false binary that the mom presented in that piece. I'd rather have a son who's alive than a daughter who's dead. Really, there's nothing in between? And there's nothing in between a child who says that I identify as something other than my biological sex. There's nothing in between. You either accept that and promote it, or you turn them out of the house? No, there's a lot in between. That's why I said it's a false binary. There's a lot in between. If you have a child who's suffering from gender dysphoria or maybe just going through a phase, you neither indulge nor excommunicate. Is that a possibility?
I mean, is that a possibility?
Yeah, it is a possibility. So one bad choice that begets other bad choices doesn't legitimize the original bad choice. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Matt Purple, online editor for the Spectator's World Edition. Matt, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, guys. Good to be here.
So what was your reaction to the piece similar to Matt Walsh's? You see this as a betrayal and it needs to be called out, even if you want to be empathetic to the family and young Ryland and other kids and families in that situation?
Yeah, I mean... When I was 5, I thought I was maybe Batman, you know, but the point is, as I got older, I grew out of that. And what worries me is not that there are trans people and there are people who suffer from gender dysphoria. And in very, very rare cases, that gender dysphoria continues into adulthood, and they need help and they need sympathy. And it's not an easy thing to suffer from. I know people who have suffered from it. But that is almost never, it is almost never the case that when you have it in childhood, it just continues, right? Kids almost always grow out of it, because kids go through phases and kids go through stages. And to say that because this kid is like when he's five or even when he's a teenager, that therefore we need to normalize this and we need to, you know, make him think that he is this way, allow him to transition. That's my real objection with what's happening here with that Fox report, as well as with, you know, the pushing puberty blockers on kids, you know, transition surgery for minors, the entire trans culture that's being created here.
Well, it's a business. I mean, there's a whole wing at Children's Lurie Hospital now with, you know, with just what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's being marketed, and it's become trendy. And I heard you guys were talking about the highest of all high holy holidays, you know, the Pride Week on our liturgical calendar here. It can feel like every week is Pride Week. I wasn't aware that it was in June, right? I guess we're sticking all of our new holidays, like Juneteenth, all of them are getting put in June. But it can feel so pervasive that you're not even sure when the actual date is, right? Because it's just very, this has become a part of our culture. There are neighborhoods you can walk through in Washington, D.C., near where I live, where there's just, you know, rainbow flags and Black Lives Matter and Respect Trans Lives. There's these things out all the time, year-round. And so it can be difficult to know, but that is absolutely a marketing phenomenon, as well as a, you know, an attempt to work through a difficult issue.
Flannery O'Connor observed that sentimentality leads to the gas chamber, and this trans movement is an example of it, because all you get is sentiment, and there's no, I mean, like on so many issues, and there's no examination of the results. And by the way, if you if you hear stories that don't fit, then you deplatform those individuals. So the individuals who've gone through transitioning and then detransitioned because they found out that it didn't address what was otherwise lacking or afflicting them, they're marginalized to the periphery of the discussion rather than being central to the discussion, because we're supposed to celebrate. We're only allowed to celebrate, and we're only allowed to do what a five-year-old wants us to do. Dr. Jay Green, writing over at Heritage Foundation, too, on the actual medical implications of this, I'm insulted, actually, that mom, I understand she has to rationalize what she's done, that mom, I'd rather have a live boy or a live son than a dead daughter. That is so despicable to say something like that, and it's indicative of how pernicious sentimentality is. Jay Green, lowering legal barriers to make it easier for minors to undergo cross-sex medical interventions without parental consent does not reduce suicide rates. In fact, it likely leads to higher rates of suicides among young people in states that adopt these changes. So you think you're preventing somebody, you know, the Trevor Project is cited, and they're an LGBTQ, radical LGBTQ advocacy organization. You think you're addressing the mental health issues? No, in most cases, or the majority of the cases, from the data, you're exacerbating them.
Yeah, I think it's true. And it's, you know, the suicide rate is incredibly high among trans individuals. And so it can be a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't thing. It is why they do need sympathy and sensitivity. But the problem is sympathy and sensitivity does not mean giving into your child. Right. And that's not just true of trans. That's true of the countless issues that we all go through during adolescence. I mean, it is a pummeling time. I think of all my years in life, the ones I'd like to return to least were those in high school, because if it's not gender dysphoria, there's something else that's going to get to you, that's going to be gnawing at your consciousness, right? And that is why you need parents who are strong. You need parents who don't just give in to every, you know, demand that their kids start giving. And the pressure from the culture right now is that if your children are going through this particular situation, it isn't just that you have to give in. You have to give in, you know, possibly a disfiguring way. I mean, a permanent way. And if you don't, if you refuse to, then it's bigotry. That is a very pernicious message. And I think it's not surprising that you're seeing more and more parents cave. And that's, you know, that's pretty horrific.
So what are you suggesting that they do? That they go to counseling? Or what would, if you were that mom, what would you have done differently?
Yeah, you have to take it seriously, first of all, right? I mean, you shouldn't stigmatize your kids. You shouldn't act like, you know, that the devil is in them or something like this. I mean, it is possible to go too far in the opposite direction too. They need care and they need attention. But you know, you go to counseling, you sit with them, you talk with them, you work through it the same way you would if they were depressed or if they were feeling lonely, if they were going through any other condition of adolescence, and you treat it that way. And then if it persists later in life, then, you know, they become adults and they're free to make their own decisions, that's a different question. But we're talking about children here, right? We're talking about people who are young enough that they inherently rely on the care and the guidance of others. And they need to get that care and that guidance, not just a wholesale surrender.
Wanted to tackle this piece that you wrote about violence in America, specifically as it relates to the pandemic. And again, we're talking about still trying to assess the damage that was done. And essentially, one of the things you argue is that, you know, we weren't all in it together. And you're not in it together like we war on COVID. You weren't in a foxhole with somebody. That war on COVID, where we were all in it together, a lot of people were in it by themselves in isolation. And maybe that in part helps to explain, maybe there is a correlation between that isolation, the spike in mental illness issues, and some of the associated violence.
Yeah, what really drew my eye to this was a spike in carjackings that I noticed among teenagers, right? You had teens as young as like 13 years old who were stealing cars, jacking cars, sometimes at gunpoint, and then driving the cars around, posting them on video on social media, and then oftentimes just abandoning them, right? It was not,
just for fun.
It wasn't gang violence necessarily. It wasn't done with much of a purpose. It was just off to get a joyride or off to get your kicks. There was a nihilism to it, a pointlessness to it, that you know, crime in America is very high relatively, but not all crime is pointless in that same way. And so it made me think about the, you know, greater violence in America today. And one thing that you hear over and over again is that the reason why these crimes are happening, especially among teens, is that during the pandemic, all those avenues were shut off, mm-hmm. right? The classrooms weren't there. The after-school sports weren't there. Latchkey wasn't there. And, you know, those urges, that desire to act out had to come out somewhere. And I think that's what we're seeing now.
Although there's something else, too. I mean, there's something else that's different about American culture from other countries where there were significant lockdowns, too, and you just don't see the same spike in violence. I mean, you actually saw, for example, a decline in murders per capita in Mexico City. So there's still something. I mean, and I'm not saying you're saying this is the only thing. It's part of it, perhaps, part of the conversation. But there's still something else that's going on with family and institutions in this country that are part of the puzzle.
It's a vast mosaic. Yeah, I think there are many reasons why this is happening, and there's a greater cultural rot there too. There's the, you know, the increased breakdown of the family. There is, you know, sometimes we don't like to talk about this issue as conservatives, but it is very easy to get a gun in this country, which then allows you to carry out violent crime if you want to. But you can run the gamut. I mean, I think it's a very complicated picture, but I just come back to the nihilism of it. You know, it's very striking, the idea that anybody, even in a country of 330 million people, would take up an AR-style weapon and start shooting at children in an elementary school classroom, not even the first time this decade that's happened, that there is something wrong there. There's something very wrong. And it's not just as simple as, you know, let's take everybody's ARs away. There's something deeper that is happening there.
Yeah, these little bands of Clockwork Orange kids. Matt Purple, online editor for The Spectator's World Edition. Matt, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Cobretti Williams is a senior editor for diversity, equity, and inclusion at Best Colleges. He just penned a piece over at RealClearPolitics.com. Working in higher ed sucks. Here's why I left. It may not be what you think in terms of the reasons he left. Cobretti Williams, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So what sucked, I guess, past tense, about it, and why did you leave?
Really great question. So I think for me, and I think many other folks who are coming into higher education, we wanted to come into the field to make a difference. We wanted to work with students who were pursuing an education and who are going to go out into the world or go out and change the world. But I think working very long hours for a university that purports that the mission is what matters and nothing else beyond your physical and mental well-being at times. And in addition to not getting fair compensation for many of the roles that require higher educational experience. So for that and myriads of other reasons, I decided to leave to go where my work would be valued, to where I felt like the times and the industries and what would be required of our workforce moving forward would be welcomed.
Well, what specifically did they do to make you feel undervalued?
Well, I happen to be working in a student affairs administrative position. And as I pointed out in the article, I would often be working about 60 hours per week, which is obviously goes beyond the standard 40-hour work week, if we believe in a 40-hour work week, but that's an entirely different story. And during that time, I had just graduated with my master's degree. And I honestly, I don't think I was making the appropriate amount that I should have been making, and the benefits that were offered with the job were not there for me to feel like this was a safe environment at the time. Now, granted, I still needed to get professional experience that I think a lot of folks coming into an entry-level role need to get in order to advance. I think a lot of us who go into higher education see that we want to become a president and a dean of students one day. And I think the road there is a lot longer than people think. Often it takes about 10 to 15 years to get to those higher-level positions where you're able to have the impact you want and also to be fairly compensated, I would say, in terms of higher education administrative positions on campus. So very long hours, very low pay, considering that I just came in with a master's degree that also came with its own price tag. I think I was hoping for a red carpet in that regard, something a little bit more than $30,000 a year, which, I mean, if you're living in a metropolitan area, that's
nothing.
Not livable, especially in Chicago.
How old were you when you started there making $30,000 a year with your master's degree?
I was 23 at the
23,
time.
23, right out of college. Yeah.
Right after I had gotten my bachelor's. I had graduated from undergrad early, but I had got my master's when I was 23, and then I went directly to work for that employer.
Well, what made you feel unsafe?
What was your master's in?
My master's was in student development administration and educational policy. So a lot of my work involved analyzing and improving and creating best practices for student programs on campus, in addition to obviously what happens inside the classroom. There's also the student experience that happens outside the classroom, when it comes to programs and events on campus, support services that are provided for students that will create a holistic college experience for them. In addition to that, also analyzing institutional policies and how those impact students, staff, and faculty, particularly those who are coming from historically excluded communities and identities.
You had mentioned just that you didn't feel safe. Can you expand on that? What made you feel unsafe?
I think what made me feel unsafe was that oftentimes, I think when you're working that many hours on a regular, and I wouldn't say necessarily physically safe beyond just I was very burnt out, and there was very little regard for the fact that faculty and administrators who were working in this specific department, and I think across a lot of departments at colleges and universities, are burnt out and tired. And I get it. There's a mission that needs to be adhered to, and we're really all here for the students. But when we go home at the end of the day, like, we still have lives, we still have families, we still have expenses. We still have work preferences and considerations that should be made just like every other sector makes for their employers that they value. I would say not feeling safe, I felt often indisposable in that regard, in the sense of my work not mattering to the point where I would be considered even for maybe you should take a couple of days here. It wasn't a really safe environment to talk about PTO or take PTO. You often felt guilty for taking it. And again, that on top of the hours, with, again, little regard for the morale of staff and faculty after working pretty much 10 to 12 months around the clock during the academic year. Because it's not, I mean, a college and university, in some senses, it's an 8-to-5, but in many cases, like, there's student life that happens after that point too. So, which a lot of positions often have to tap in there.
Okay. All right. Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us. That's Cabretti Williams, PhD senior editor for diversity, equity, and inclusion at Best Colleges. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line. Thank you.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, getting a lot of messages about why we had Mr. Cabretti Williams on the show. Well, I think the point is obvious. Although I cut out, so I had much more to go over with him, but unfortunately we had a bit of a technical issue here. It's obvious. 23-year-old with a master's who has never been out of academia. His first job is in academia, and he feels unsafe because he feels underpaid.
Right.
And he's entitled to this. 60-hour work week is something that's, you know, a foreign concept to him for however long he was able to manage 60-hour work weeks. The perspective he doesn't have for the number of people that work 60 hours plus a week to make ends meet. And also the complete lack of understanding he has of even the environment he was in. We've talked quite a bit about colleges and universities in this country and what the economics are. So college textbooks and college tuition over the last 20 years from 1998 to December of 2018, this is from our friend Mark Perry at the University of Michigan, have increased at about 4 times the rate of inflation, outpacing by a wide margin child care, medical care services. Oh, by the way, hourly wages. About 2.5 times hourly wages, housing, food and beverage costs, and then, of course, the things that have actually decreased as compared to the rate of inflation, cars, home furnishings, clothing, cell phone through technology, and so on and so forth. So there's no perspective there. Since he was the Dye person for Best Colleges, Dye editor for Best Colleges, it would have been fun to have him address things like the University of Michigan, where they employ nearly 100 full-time diversity-related administrative staffers that cost $9 million a year. More than a quarter of those 100 full-time diversity-related administrative staffers have annual salaries in excess of $100,000, not including the benefits, not including the, well, which would include the pensions. It would be interesting to have them discuss Ohio State, which spends more than $10 million on 131 diversity administrators, the equivalent of in-state tuition for more than 1,000 students at Ohio State University. And this is what you have. This is the story. Actually, the story is faculty salaries have increased at just a little bit above the rate of inflation over the last 25 years. But admit the increase in the size of the bureaucracy at colleges and these niche areas like diversity administrators making six figures. That's that helps to explain the delta between the increase in, or the delta between the increase in college tuition and the lack of increase when it comes to salaries of some lower level positions like he had as some sort of academic advisor,
right,
or some student affairs rep.
Life isn't fair. I mean, $30,000 right out of college, that's not bad.
So where's all the money going? All the money is going to build out all of this bureaucracy at the collegiate level, and then of course it's a politicized bureaucracy at that. I've been, you know, that the whole $30,000 in a metropolitan area, first job out of college, effectively, you know, it's I was undervalued. Okay, well, you know, what should the salary be? And now put the salary in the context of where college tuition is for the actual individuals underwriting it, taxpayers generally at public universities plus parents, and parents at private universities. You know, I mean, it's just a navel-gazing, and he wants to feel, he had his vocabulary confused, he felt indisposable. What he meant to say is, I felt disposable. Yeah, well, you know, welcome to being a cog in the machine at a business. You want to make yourself feel indispensable or indisposable, then add value or go do something that you find rewarding. If you can go do something you find rewarding and also put food on the table, then bully for you. But this idea that, you know, not only do I get to call my shots in terms of salary and benefits and work hours, but if I feel, you know, unfulfilled, I have all this talent that is going unappreciated. You know, welcome to the party,
right,
buddy.
Life's not fair. And then if you don't like your job, keep your job while you look for another job.
So, but you have to hear from these people, because we can talk about it, and I can rattle off those statistics I just rattled off for the examples of Ohio State and Michigan, and go macro, go micro. But to actually hear the perspective, the mentality that has been fostered in so many young people, including young people who, you know, clearly did well academically, got through college, got his master's degree. That is a small fraction of the population with advanced degrees. And yet that is one of the more destructive philosophies you heard that you're going to hear. But that's what's ubiquitous, that entitled attitude in so many quarters here. In so many quarters in America now, it's starting, of course, in the hallowed halls of academia. So I'm glad he came on the show, because I think people need to actually hear it to believe that there are people, and there are a lot of people, that have Mr. Williams' philosophy on life. You know, what they deserve, and
what
as
they
Milton
didn't
Friedman,
get and, all that.
And as Milton Friedman famously said, "Thank God we don't get what we deserve."
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.